This is volume 77 of the Mars Hill Audio Journal. I'm Ken Myers. In early 1993, when I was first getting the Mars Hill Audio project launched, I called a friend to get some advice about who I might be able to interview about the work of novelist P.D. James. He recommended Alan Jacobs, a professor at Wheaton College whose name I vaguely remembered from articles he'd written in First Things. I called him up, introduced myself, and he took a chance on this unknown, untried audio journal, whatever that was. It proved to be a fruitful relationship. We've enjoyed almost 20 conversations featured on what was then called the Mars Hill Tapes and then became the Mars Hill Audio Journal. 10 of those interviews were featured in the first 3 years of our publication. Until 2001, Alan and I had never met face-to-face. This surprised a lot of listeners, who assumed our conversations were the product of casual, perhaps even fireside encounters, possibly lubricated by sherry or mint juleps. No, Alan was sitting in a studio somewhere on the campus of Wheaton College, and I was sitting in my little studio here in Virginia, our encounter enabled by some technical sleight of hand that only makes it sound that we're face-to-face. We finally did meet, and actually enjoyed one another's company, which is always gratifying when you've enjoyed a long-distance relationship for so many years. Alan has not appeared on the journal for 3 years, in part because he's been busy writing the book that is the occasion for his appearance on this issue. I was quite surprised some time back to discover that he was working on a biography of C.S. Lewis. I was surprised because Alan had written an article on Lewis back in 1994, in which he failed to adopt an appropriately reverential posture, and for which he was rather enthusiastically castigated by readers who had apparently assumed that Lewis would have liked being regarded as infallible, ineffable, and saint only wise. The behavioral modification to which Alan was subjected cured him of his foolish ways. Then an editor from a major publisher approached Alan Jacobs with the idea of writing a biography of Lewis. It was not a project high on his to-do list. But the more he talked with the perseverant publishers about the kind of book that they had in mind, the more he thought it might be an interesting assignment.
Mickey Maudlin is the editor at Harper who approached me and asked me to write this book. And at first I said, I don't think so. I said, you know, does the world really need any more books about C.S. Lewis? And he said, well, I think it needs some more good books about C.S. Lewis. So that was... I thought, well, that's flattering, you know. He thinks I could write a good book, so that's good. And then I was also concerned about whether I was the right person to do it, since I'm not a Lewis specialist as such. And it turned out that that was one of the reasons why they wanted me to do it. They felt that enough books had been done by the professional Lewisians, and it was it would be good to get the point of view of someone who was not quite so much permanently involved with the Lewis canon and the world of Lewis. That made me feel a little better as well. But they were quite clear from the beginning. Harper was quite clear from the beginning that they wanted the book to be called The Narnian. And I was a little unhappy with that because I didn't like the idea of someone telling me what the title should be of a book that I hadn't written yet. But also because I was afraid that this might create a kind of a forced quality to the book, you know, that it's supposed to be a biography of Lewis, but then you've got to find some way to tie everything in to Narnia somehow because of this big movie coming out and all of that. And that was something that gave me a lengthy pause. And then I started thinking about it, and I went back and reread some Lewis books in preparation for it as I was thinking through it. And one of the books that I decided to reread, I didn't decide at that point to reread all of the Narnia books, but I picked up The Magician's Nephew, which is one that's always been a favorite of mine. And as I was reading it, I noticed I noticed something that I had thought about some years before, but not in any depth. And that is that some of the themes in The Magician's Nephew echo themes that are in some of his nonfiction books. And in particular, I was interested in the way that Uncle Andrew is portrayed there because he is the magician of the title, and yet his language is that of scientific experiment. For some reason, I always find myself imagining Uncle Andrew in a white lab coat, even though he clearly doesn't wear a white lab coat. That's what I imagine him wearing. I mean, he even has guinea pigs, for heaven's sake. He ties the magic rings to the guinea pigs and to see what happens to them. So I just thought it was curious that he's a magician, and yet there is this aura of scientific experimentation. He is a seeker after knowledge and all of that. And then I remembered that Lewis points out in The Abolition of Man that in the 16th century, science and magic were closely allied endeavors. And even the founder of experimental science, as he is sometimes called, Sir Francis Bacon, said that the aim of the magicians is noble, that they're trying to do the same thing that he's trying to do, expand the frontiers of knowledge, but to do so in a somewhat different way. And what Lewis points out in that book is that at the time, nobody knew that over the long run, science would work and magic wouldn't. They were two different ways of trying to increase our knowledge, and in fact, they overlapped considerably. I mean, it was very difficult at that time, for instance, to separate the amount of chemistry in alchemy from the amount of magic alchemy.
Newton was very interested in alchemy, for instance.
Newton was, and this is 100 years later, but yeah. Newton is very interested in alchemy and does, you know, everybody's, what we hear about Newton all the time is his experiments in optics and gravitation and his invention of the calculus, but people don't realize that he spent more time working on alchemy and writing a commentary on the Book of Revelation than he did in any of those things. So I was reading The Magician's Nephew then, and I was noticing this correspondence to The Abolition of Man. And then I remembered also that he says something very similar in his great History of English Literature in the 16th century. And what gradually dawned on me was that almost everything that Lewis really cared about and that he deeply believed in, almost everything that he thought was vital for us to know, no matter how scholarly, no matter how intellectual, found its way somehow into the Narnia books. And to a shocking degree, actually, you wouldn't think that he would be able to get all of that stuff into a series of what are, after all, relatively brief books for children. And yet he did. Hmm. And when I realized that, I thought, you know, this could actually work. There is a sense in which you could organize your account of the growth and development of Lewis's mind and his imagination around themes that arise in the Narnia books. And so at that point, I thought this not only might be worth doing, but it might be a lot of fun. So I agreed to do it.
Now, when did you run across the line from Owen Barfield that you quote, where Barfield describes Lewis as saying what he thought about everything was secretly present in what he said about anything?
Yeah, I had read that years ago, but had forgotten it. And so it was somewhere in the middle of my researches that I came across it again and thought, aha, this is going to be the clinching statement that I can put in my introduction. Though I found soon after that, a wonderful quotation from Ruth Pitter, a poet who was a friend of his, in fact, a woman that some of his friends thought he might marry before he met Joy Davidman. And she wrote of Lewis, "In fact, his whole life was oriented and motivated by an almost uniquely persisting child's sense of glory and of nightmare. The adult events were received into a medium still as pliable as wax, wide open to the glory, and equally vulnerable, with a man's strength to feel it all and a great scholar's and writer's skills to express and to interpret." Yeah. And I thought that was a very powerful word, in some ways even more deeply insightful than Barfield's comment, because it reveals the sense in which Lewis's childhood, both the glories and the terrors of his childhood never left him. And that, I think, had a lot to do with his ultimate need. He felt it as a need, not just as a desire, but as a need to write stories for children.
It also suggests something about the prominence of his imagination as opposed to his reasoning by talking about a child's sense of glory and of nightmare, whereas the Barfield quote, "what he thought about everything," suggests that that he's a kind of simply a great mind that's weaving all of these ideas. When it's not just I'm reminded of the story I've heard about Leon Kass's tenure at the President's Council on Bioethics, and when he gathered these this council together for one of their first meetings together, a group that included ethicists and theologians, but also included entrepreneurs in the biotech world and a lot of researchers. He asked them all to read Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Birthmark, and they were going to discuss this together. And apparently, a lot of the scientific types were really offended that he would do something so childish as to make them read a story.
Yeah, because the assumption of this sort of disenchanted world is that whatever Hawthorne is doing in The Birthmark, it's not productive of knowledge. It doesn't have anything to do with knowledge. He may be giving us a pretty picture or an interesting picture or a frightening picture, but it's not knowledge.
And hence irrelevant for setting public policy.
That's exactly right. It's irrelevant because it is not knowledge. I mean, how you respond to a story like that, many people would think, because of this enchantment of disenchantment that has been laid upon them, whatever you think about a story like that, however it makes you feel, those are just feelings. That's just part of the private world, and that has nothing to do with the issues that we've gotten together to discuss, in this case, bioethics and whether there should be national policy on bioethical issues. And Kass is saying precisely the opposite. He is saying that how we feel, how we respond to this story is part of what it is teaching us, and what if we stop and reflect about that, if we allow the symbols of this story to give rise to thought, then what we will discover is that we are learning something, and we are learning something that which will be of value to us as we try to establish policy in bioethics. And that, and of course, the ultimately what Kass does is to release this great big report from the President's Council on Bioethics, which consists completely of stories, poems. The kind of literature which forces us to reflect, perhaps in unexpected or surprising ways, about our assumptions and why we have them. So Kass is acting on a very Lewisian kind of model here by insisting that here's how we begin our conversation about bioethics, is by testing our hearts, that is, testing our responses. How are we formed as persons? Because if how we respond to all of these stories will be determined by how we have been formed as persons, and only if we know that can we take into account then our formation as we work through policy issues. It's a shockingly bold thing to do, and probably has been treated by a lot of people with great skepticism. But I think it was a stroke of genius for Kass to say, no, let's start here. Let's start here because these stories are going to reveal something about us that we need to know if we are going to be makers of policy.
And it's no accident that Kass says The Abolition of Man is one of the most influential books he ever read.
Sure, because it is exactly on principles articulated by The Abolition of Man that Kass is acting, or was acting, before he resigned from the President's Council on Bioethics, which is something I was very sorry to hear.
Let's go back into Lewis's own reflection on imagination, which he does write a lot about it, and perhaps one of the most famous things in the I think it's in the introductory essay to the little anthology of Gems from George MacDonald that he edited, where he refers to the experience of reading George MacDonald as baptizing his imagination. What does he that's a phrase that's often referred to, but I'm not sure people understand what he had in mind when he says that.
Well, in order to understand that, you have to back up a little bit and account for the term imagination, because I think I actually didn't get a chance to talk about this in the book. It because it is a biography, it felt like a distraction, but it's something that I ultimately want to be able to write about at greater length. It's difficult for us to understand what Lewis means by the baptizing of the imagination, because the term imagination as we use it is rather different from the term as Lewis used it. And the way that the term imagination is commonly used really derives from the Romantics, and especially from Samuel Taylor Coleridge around the turn of the 19th century. And Coleridge is in some ways the great theorist of the imagination or the great thinker about the imagination. But for him, it is any act of the human mind, which, as Coleridge puts it, is a kind of a reenactment in finite minds of the infinite act of imagination that God put forth when he created the world. And so it is a kind of to imagine, to exercise the imagination, is to repeat in our finite way the creative power of God. And so that is how it is often thought, that the person who imagines, the person with imagination, is the person with almost divine creative power. And in fact, a successor of Coleridge's, Percy Shelley, would say, no, the poet is divine. It's not almost. The poet actually is divine. When Lewis talks about imagination, though, he's not really thinking in those terms. He never stops to define what he means. But if you know how he was formed and you know what his interests are, you would be aware that it was not the Romantics which primarily formed his thinking about these issues, but rather thinkers of a much earlier period. And if you look at the Defense of Poetry, or sometimes called An Apology for Poetry, written by Sir Philip Sidney in the 1580s, he makes a really interesting distinction there. Now, in the Bibles which Sidney would have had access to, the English Bibles that Sidney would have had access to, the word imagination turns up several times, but always in a pejorative sense. So there is the passage from Isaiah, which is quoted in the New Testament. Why do the peoples imagine a vain thing? And so imagination is, in the biblical language, not a positive word. It's a word which describes illusory thoughts. To imagine something is to fantasize that something exists that really doesn't. And Sidney says that is one of the things that poets do. He says poets do fantasize or come up with things that do not exist and, in fact, should not exist. They imagine vain things, and he calls this fantasticae, the fantastic. But he says there's another thing that poets do, and he calls that the eikasticae, or he probably would have said eikastic. Fantastic and eikastic is probably how he would have said it. And the eikastic imagination is one that envisions with particular power and force a deep spiritual truth. And so Sidney is very clear that if poetry goes the path of the fantastic, it is dangerous. And it pulls us farther away from truth, just as Plato always said poetry did. But if the poet is a Christian and is a man of virtue and is someone who is seeking wisdom and excellence, then the poet can create, eikastically, he would say, an image, a beautiful image of the truth, in the much the same way that we're told in the New Testament that Jesus Christ is the image, the very image of the Father. So that is the model of the imagination that Lewis always worked with, Sidney's, not Coleridge's, and is one in which the imagination can be exercised towards vice, towards illusion, towards distortion. And these are the ways in which the evil one and his henchmen use imagination. But it can be also used to envision something true and to envision it deeply and powerfully. So when he says that George MacDonald, reading George MacDonald was a baptism for his imagination, what he means is that it was the means by which his imagination was redirected from this fantastic sort of illusory world to a love of and a desire for the truth. So MacDonald was huge for him because up until that time, he had been exercising his imagination in ways that had little or nothing to do with the pursuit of the true, the good, and the beautiful. But after reading MacDonald, he found himself drawn powerfully and deeply towards something that was true, good, and beautiful. He had holiness imagined for him. And he participated through the exercise of his own imagination in that holiness. And it was ultimately by working his imagination in that way that he, without realizing he was doing so, laid the groundwork for his ultimate conversion to Christianity.
Would Lewis have had a, because he appreciated how the imagination could be such a gracious thing in the fullest sense of the word, I assume he would have a particular fear and loathing for a pernicious imagination, for people who were the fantastics.
Yeah, and I think that he was in a tough situation in this regard, because in a culture in which the sort of the dominant forces are ones which dismiss the entire realm of the imaginative as being part only of the private world, not worthy of entering into public discourse, and so on, he really had a task before him to try to generate a respect for imaginative power. But if he does that, and he does that uncritically, then he can increase respect for this false kind of imagination. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky thing for him to do. And I think the way that he handles that pretty consistently in his work is to show over and over again that the things which people believe in the 20th century that created the most pain and the most misery were a result of their being captivated by a certain kind of imagination. That is, that people like Stalin and Hitler and the kind of person which he seems to have actually come into contact with from time to time, the person who on supposedly scientific grounds is going to reorganize the entire society. These are the sorts of people that he writes about, not only in The Abolition of Man, but especially in That Hideous Strength, in the novel That Hideous Strength. That all of these people are people who get somewhere in the world, who gain influence, who gain followers, who gain prestige and power, chiefly because of their ability to imagine something which seems desirable to people. And sometimes it's no more than a matter of getting people to imagine how wonderful it would be to be one of the insiders to this group, to belong to what Lewis called the inner ring, to be the ones who are making the decisions, the ones who are acting, not the ones who are being acted upon. It might be just that, but it's generally something more than that, some picture of the way that life ought to be or the way that society ought to be constructed. So one of the things that Lewis does is to show that the work of imagination is going on all the time around us, and even the people who most strenuously dismiss it are actually using it all the time in order to influence others. Mm. And you can see that most clearly and most directly in most stripes, in which you see how what Screwtape is telling Wormwood to do with his patient over and over and over again is to create in his mind certain kinds of vague images, certain kinds of desires, certain pictures of how he wants his life to go, and get the patient to follow these illusory demons, because that's ultimately what they are, these illusions which become demons, that to follow them until he reaches his own destruction.
Somewhere Lewis said that advertising was the one vocation he couldn't imagine a Christian going into. Is this range of concerns behind that judgment on his part? You know,
I think for Lewis, the advertising world is one in which, if you work in that world, Lewis would think. And I have a lot of sympathy for this, for this way of looking at things. If you look at that world, what you are charged with doing is creating desirable images without pausing to ask whether they are the illusory sort of images or the truth yielding sort of images. Hmm. And so the only way that you could possibly live as a Christian in that environment would be in Lewis's estimation, if you insisted on maintaining that distinction between the two kinds of imagination, in which case you would have to refuse a lot of jobs. Mm-hmm. And so you probably wouldn't stay in the business very long. It would be extraordinarily difficult to be successful.
And refuse certain approaches to advertising products that might be more lucrative, but...
Yeah, and again, this goes back to the whole question of the symbol giving rise to the thought. What Lewis believed that the proper function of the imagination, or the human imagination when it is functioning as it's supposed to function, is not to prevent you from thinking, not to prevent you from inquiring, but rather to stimulate inquiry, to stimulate reflection, to stimulate thought, so that you can move deeper into an
I want to take a brief footnote or an appendix to this discussion and see if you have a comment that might be helpful. I recently spoke to a group of parents whose children attend a Christian school that is very deliberate about the curriculum and I think deliberate about the imaginative life of the students.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points I wanted to make to the parents was that the shape of their child's imagination, the shape of the imagination of their children was a matter of as much concern as catechetical training was.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know exactly how to make that case, or I think I knew how to make the case, but I wasn't sure how to instruct them in the task of nurturing a healthy imagination. It's easy to know how to do catechism
right.
with a kid, but how do you nurture a healthy imagination? That seems to be such an elusive thing, but it does seem to me to be true that's part of a parental responsibility.
It is part of it, and you know, I wish I had an answer to this. because I really don't. If I did, I would tell you, and you and I could make a lot of money.
We would make a lot of money.
You know, but I think this is in some ways Lewis's deepest concern. I'm not sure that anything is deeper in him than the concern for catechesis to be a catechesis of the imagination, mm-hmm. and a catechesis of the moral sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because above all, the divine things must be made attractive and desirable to people. And the fact that Lewis, you can tell that Lewis knew how difficult that is by the way that he wrote his little story, The Great Divorce. Because you see in The Great Divorce that as all of these people are transported from hell to the beginnings of the heavenly realm, sort of the outskirts of the heavenly realm, it's miserable for them. I mean, it's painful. The grass hurts them. Everything is anything that they might want to carry away is too heavy for them to lift. It's a place of enormous discomfort because they have not been shaped and formed in such a way that this is beautiful and desirable to them. It doesn't feel like home. And it doesn't feel like home, not because they have failed to learn their catechism, though that's probably true too, but it doesn't feel like home to them because they have never been taught to find beautiful and true things desirable. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question of, well, are you willing to begin now? That's the question that they're all confronted with. Are you willing to begin now? Trusting that if you stay here long enough and if you work hard to habituate yourself to this environment, it will become more and more beautiful to you, more and more desirable. It will feel more and more like home. And that was, I think, just the way that story is put together shows how deeply Lewis was concerned with this absolute necessity for educating people's hearts, their chests, their moral imagination, their sense of what is desirable, because ultimately Lewis was very Augustinian in this regard, that we are defined most completely by what we love, the orientation of our will. What is it that our will gravitates towards? What is it that it is drawn towards? And if our will, the desire of our hearts is not towards Jesus Christ, is not towards the Lord, is not towards all of the good and holy and pure things which the St. Paul tells us we should be focusing on, then we're in big trouble. You know, we might be saved, but, you know, by the skin of our teeth, you know, we just barely make ourselves get in there with the wood, hay, and stubble being consumed all around us, you know. And I think that becomes the great question is, how do you make the good, the true, and the beautiful desirable to people? And, you know, ultimately, the only answer that I can give to that is one that I'd rather not give, and that is that they have to see it in us.
Uh-huh.
You know, that people who are not Christians or people who are our children have to look at us and see something of the love of God in the light of our countenance. And if it's not there, then they will not be attracted to it and will not find it desirable. And you know, I'd love to find some way to get around that because I don't want that responsibility.
Well, maybe you can at least have your kids read George MacDonald so they'll at least see it in his characters, if not in you.
Exactly, exactly. You know, it's always good to say, here, son, read this. Pay no attention to daddy.
<That's right. laughs> Alan Jacobs, who teaches English at Wheaton College. He's the author of A Theology of Reading, The Hermeneutics of Love, Shaming the Devil, Essays in Truth-Telling, and most recently, The Narnian, The Life and Imagination of C.S. Lewis. And that brings us to the end of Volume 77 of the Mars Hill Audio Journal. We had engineering assistance this time from Rick Bierling, Hank Hadley, and Brian Porrick. From radio stations WQED, WGVU, and KCBX, and from the Wheaton Media Center. Our administrative work is managed by Carolyn Barnes, Gretchen Stelling, and Jim Heat-Dirks. Our assistant editor is Amy Grazer. I'm Ken Myers. On this edition's CD bonus track, Alan Jacobs and I continue our discussion about C.S. Lewis. You mentioned something... Again, in your introductory chapters, you're kind of outlining where you're going with the book. You have a very curious passage. It is not likely that a man with such an open mind would remain an atheist for long. So something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
That you're referring to Lewis. Mm-hmm. That might kind of strike some dissonance in some people. That you have to be really open minded. That if you're really open minded, you'll drop your atheism.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Lewis was, you have to understand that this was someone who was born at the end of the Victorian age, and he was educated primarily, or I should say, his crucial years of education were conducted by a man named W.T. Kirkpatrick, whom he called Kirk or the Knock or the Great Knock. And Kirk was a late Victorian atheist. He was someone who, as a young man in the middle of the 19th century, had been training to be a Presbyterian minister, had lost his faith, had become an atheist. According to Lewis, the only trace that remained of his Christian upbringing was that he wore a nicer suit on Sundays than he wore the other days of the week. But he still went out and worked in the garden on Sundays instead of going to church. And was a quite even violent at times opponent of Christianity, and that the model again we go back to the disenchantment of the world. It was that Kirk had come to embrace a disenchanted world, had come to believe that anything that could not be substantiated by a strict calculus of rationality did not exist, should not be taken seriously, must be forcibly banished from our intellectual presence. And as a result, there was much that he was simply forbidden to think about. His own creed as a rationalist, a high and dry rationalist, as Lewis called him, his own creed as a rationalist forbade him to think even to consider anything that he could not immediately see as having strong claim to rational plausibility. And that was ultimately what was so suffocating to Lewis about that kind of rationalism, even though for many years he embraced it himself and was twice as fierce as Kirk had ever been in his denunciation of Christianity as superstition. Ultimately, though, that became stifling to him because there was so much that he was not allowed to consider, that he was not allowed to reflect on. And I think primarily what that forced him to do was to dismiss all of the books that he loved the most, all of the music that he loved the most, every artistic impulse and desire that he had, to dismiss them all as being irrelevant at best and misleading or harmful at worst. And so he went through a period of years there where he did everything he could to kill that part of him that that was drawn to the symbols, the images, the myths, the beauty of art. And he couldn't do it. Ultimately, he couldn't kill it. He came pretty close, I think. And I have a suspicion that if he had gotten a job in philosophy, which was the first degree that he took at Oxford, rather than in English, he might have ultimately been able to kill it off. He might have been able to kill off his desire to write poetry. He might have been able to kill off his love for the music of Wagner. He might have been able to kill off anything that wasn't, in this very, very narrow sense, rational. But in the providence of God, a philosophy job never opened for him. And once he got the job in teaching English, where his daily bread would be literature, would be storytelling, not philosophy, he wrote to his father and said, you know, maybe this is for the best, because I'm not sure that I would have survived as a philosopher. I'm afraid that it might have done me in. He doesn't say exactly what he means, but the very strong impression that he gives is that it might very well have led him to a kind of a mental or emotional breakdown. Because he would have killed what was actually the most vibrant and intense part of himself and left only a shell. And so that whole story, I think, helps you to understand what he means when he sees the kind of 19th century atheism that Kirk professed as being the work of a closed mind. You decide a priori, you decide in advance what is and is not admissible, what you can and cannot, what you may or may not think about. And you see that very clearly in the character of McPhee in That Hideous Strength. McPhee is very clearly Kirk. He just changes the name, but he gives him all of the same mannerisms. And even when faced with abundant evidence of the supernatural, McPhee just can't let himself take the step of acknowledging that something is going on here that's really happening, but is beyond the scope of his own particularly narrow kind of rationality. And that's the sad thing about McPhee. I mean, at the end of the book, his story isn't over, but he's someone who has not been willing to step into what's called the company, the people who surround Ransom as the leader. He's not able to enter into their spiritual world, even though he's powerfully drawn to it, because he has to see his own being drawn to it as something irrational that he can't justify. So he's closed his mind to all sorts of evidence that's right there before him, because he has decided in advance that that sort of evidence is impermissible. And so it would only be by opening his mind to consider all the evidence available that McPhee might become a Christian.
I'm curious, in your research for this, how helpful the Pilgrim's Regress is in describing the person, in describing the Narnian. Can you discern the Narnian in the Pilgrim's Regress or not?
Not too much. And the reason for that is that, you know, the character John, the protagonist of the Pilgrim's Regress, is really not...
Not Lewis,
but also not even a character.
Yeah.
He's really just an observer. What Lewis was doing in The Pilgrim's Regress, which was his first work of prose, I don't think Lewis even knew he could write a book of prose until he wrote that, and he wrote it in 2 weeks. Hmm. What Lewis is doing there is dealing in a very, I think, effective and healthy way with what had to have been a sheer chaos inside his own mind, because he had recently become a Christian, maybe a year, year and a half before, after having become a clear theist, a believer in a personal God, maybe a year before that. And he had no idea how this fit into his education, his training as a scholar. He had no idea what implications this belief had for his future as a writer. He still wanted to be a poet or as a scholar. And I think he had to sit down and do a map a map of the intellectual landscape that he had passed through in his 30 years on the planet. Huh. And that's exactly what the Pilgrim's Regress is. It's a map. It's all of these different intellectual forces, different opinions, different actual persons who are given false names and who are positioned in a world. So right at the beginning of the Pilgrim's Regress, you get the Mappa Mundi, that is the map of the world, and you see here's Zeitgeist Time and here's Puritania, and you see all these places laid out before you. And I think that that was all he was trying to do in the Pilgrim's Regress, is to say, where have I been? And where have I, what have I come to? And so it was a book that he absolutely had to write, or else he would never have had any understanding of his own pilgrimage. But it's a book which I think he probably didn't need to publish, because I think it's clearly his least successful book.
Alan Jacobs, professor of English at Wheaton College and the author of The Narnian, The Life and Imagination of C.S. Lewis. I'm Ken Meyer.